We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What kind of mythical powers does a Sun Devil have? We got to consider that.
It's embarrassing, but we are who we are. We're not a very good team, but we're 3-1 somehow, and we got all the voters fooled, thinking we're pretty good.
Jaworski Lane at 275 pounds showed a heck of a lot of athletic ability.
Welcome to a very special edition, the specialist edition possible, I think, of the RotoWire College Football Podcast. I'm Nick Whalen, joined by a man who I almost feel like is part of the team at this point, and I would imagine the Georgia Bulldogs football program feels the same way. John McKechnie, back from Indy. You were on the scene. You were at the game. You posted a photo of yourself shirtless in the waning seconds of said game. We'll get into everything. Yeah, we'll break it down. We'll do a little bit of a look ahead to next year, but really, the reason we're doing this podcast is to give a window into, you know, someone who's never been to a national title game and maybe a national title victory, especially. I for one, have been to a game that ended in a loss. It would have resulted in a terribly, you know, unentertaining podcast. But what was it like for you? What was the buildup? You know, how was the road trip up there? I want to know, you know, every relevant detail to your experience being on the scene for your Georgia Bulldogs taking home the 2022 national title.
Yes, thank you for giving me the platform to just kind of let it rip and recap what was, you know, one of the craziest 48-hour stretches of my entire life. We hopped in the car, five of us, early Sunday morning, driving through the pouring rain on our way up to Indianapolis, stopped, had a nice meal at a Ruby Tuesdays in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Hey, no one said it was going to be easy.
That's right. I mean, that we earned our grit coins right off the bat. And it was funny. We're like waiting around outside of the Ruby Tuesdays at like 10:55. The Ruby Tuesdays wasn't even open yet. And then it's 11 o'clock. We're like not even sure if we can go in. And then suddenly like 10 cars pour into the parking lot. And suddenly Ruby Tuesdays was popping there in Bowling Green. But rest of the drive smooth. We get up to the Airbnb, just kind of relax, settle into the night. Right when we arrived is when the Ravens blew it against the, or I don't know if they blew it, but they lost to the Steelers. And yeah, we just kind of had a fun evening Sunday. The part of town that we were staying in had a bunch of establishments within a 2 to 3 minute walk, which was clutch because, I mean, I've kind of lost my thick Midwestern skin and my buddies certainly never even developed one in the first place. So, and it was plenty cold up in Indy. So nice to have as little walking to do as possible. Day of the game, just kind of hanging out, trying to basically distract ourselves from the nerves. A lot of guys in the group, I don't know if they truly believed it, but what they would say would always be on the pessimistic end. I don't know how we do this. Bama has Bryce Young. You know, there were so many avenues with which they could justify being a little bit negative going into it. But 3 o'clock, we head to the downtown area of Indianapolis around the stadium. Try to get into one place. It's completely packed. nowhere to settle up to the bar or anything like that. So we eventually found a tin roof, which I believe is a chain, and it's an interesting place, but it was totally full, a good mix of both Georgia and Alabama fans. And I didn't feel like there was a ton of like open animosity between the two fan bases, like some pretty lighthearted ribbing back and forth, but no like fights or anything like outrageous like that. So that was good. And then we just went into the stadium early just to sort of beat the rush, had an easy time getting in. And then we just kind of hung out on the concourse behind the ESPN set in the Alabama side end zone, which is close to where our seats were, and just kind of took in the environment. It was just so electric in there. So much excitement on both sides. It became pretty evident right away that there were a lot more Georgia fans than Alabama fans. And to me, that's not necessarily a reflection on Bama having a bad fan base or anything. Maybe a little bit spoiled, you could say. But at the same time, how many natties have they been to over the last decade? They're people that are mostly from the South. Do they really feel like going to Indianapolis in January? I kind of get it. So whereas Georgia fans totally starved for this type of thing. A lot of them opted not to go to the Orange Bowl, save their money on the off chance that they did make it to Indianapolis. And yeah, so the Dog Nation was absolutely in full force, in full throat as the game got underway. And, you know, we saw how it unfolded from there. And you know, as the game ended and it became clear that Georgia was going to kind of slay the dragon, not only slay the dragon that is Alabama, but also break their 41-year-long curse that had just been hanging over their heads for so long. So many close calls. You know, you can talk about 2012, you can talk about 2017, you can talk about the Stafford years. And finally, to be able to do it, even with a guy like Stetson Bennett, it was totally storybook. It was crazy. Just the sheer jubilation, especially on some of my friends who have been obviously lifelong Georgia fans, whereas me, I just became a fan when I got to school down there. It was really just remarkable to see. And the rest of the night was just like hugs and like, we effing did it. And then we just got back to the Airbnb, walked a brisk 40 or so minutes to get back there because we weren't going to mess with the Ubers, and we just stayed up rewatching the game. Like, there wasn't even that much partying done, just because there was so much like emotional exhaustion. We just kind of felt like sitting around eating McDonald's and rewatching the game immediately afterward, and that's kind of how we spent the late night hours into Tuesday morning.
It's funny you say that, because I have done that a number of times, you know, maybe not of a game at that level, but games that I'll attend, whether it's a basketball or a football game, even some baseball games, where you don't get the same, you know, you don't get the same sight lines. You don't get the, you know, the kind of the feel of a national title game, especially, you know, crew calling the game and with all the, you know, they had like the special 4K camera going, like, you know, you kind of get the angle that you see in the arena or in the stadium. And you get what you see on the Jumbotron, but that's about it, you know. And I know you usually have limited service at those games, and you're not really checking your phone anyway if it's a really close game. So there's actually a lot of value, I think, in going back and getting the TV experience, because it's so good. You know, nobody's debating that. But getting that along with being there in the stadium, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the word curse to describe Georgia not winning a title since that 1980 team. I feel like I haven't really heard that verbiage. You know, that to me is reserved for like the Cubs and the Red Sox, even the Bucks to some degree. But I don't really think anyone said the Bucks had like broken a curse when they won their first NBA title last year since 1971. Was that really what it was considered like in the Georgia area?
Yeah, as far as the psyche down here goes, it just by virtue of the way that they lost those close high stakes games. You know, the second and 26 against Tua Tagovailoa in Alabama a couple of years ago, them bringing in their backup quarterback, obviously, to beat them. And then the following year in the SEC championship game, following the same script in the opposite way, Tua is struggling. He's got that banged up ankle. They bring in Jalen Hurts, the guy that they had completely kind of shut down the year prior. And then Hurts is the one that does it to him in the SEC. Now, to be clear, I don't know if Georgia beats that that Clemson team necessarily, but I mean, it was still just equally or almost equally heartbreaking to lose to Bama in that way in back-to-back years. In 2012, I mean, I don't think that Georgia was – well, they kind of were. They were right there with Alabama until the very end, and then we saw how Alabama just kind of dismantled Notre Dame in the national championship the following week. So a lot of people felt like that was the missed opportunity, and had they been able to close the deal against Alabama, that they would have been able to beat Notre Dame fairly comfortably. Maybe not as well as Bama did to the Irish, but felt that way. Or, you know, the inexplicable losses during Georgia's Sugar Bowl run in 2007. And obviously that was a year where it doesn't feel like there were any great teams. I mean, it was a decent LSU team that ends up, not to take anything away from them, but surely not like a dominant team that your brain Rolodex of national champions goes to immediately. So it did feel like the curse. And you know, this year with how experience laden the defense was, and how much that they were likely to lose to the NFL draft and everything like that, it felt like this was the year to do it. And again, like with Clemson being down, with Ohio State missing the playoff, it felt like there were no more excuses for Georgia to get it done than this exact year. And they just have had so many instances of not coming through when they needed to, and they finally did it.
So I find myself on the Tin Roof website, and you are correct, it is a chain. They have 17 locations around the country in party destinations, you know, such as Birmingham, Alabama, Baltimore, Maryland. Of course, Indianapolis is on the list. There appears to be a Bon Jovi cover band who will be playing at the Indianapolis location next weekend called Slippery When Wet.
Oh, that's
you were at the right spot, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. The DJ had it going, played some Bob O'Reilly, which is the song that Georgia comes out to at their home games. They had a good mix of, you know, some old like songs that we can appreciate from our college days, some anthems, some bangers, some Sammy Adams, things of that nature to really get the vibes going. They did play some Sweet Home Alabama, which was annoying, but you know, it was unavoidable. You couldn't go somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
and
you had that
many
that.
Bama people and not have that song be played at least once, but oh well.
Yeah, I mean, glad you made it out alive. Would you say that this, is there anything that could top this for you? Like, where does Georgia football rank versus, you know, like Baltimore Ravens Super Bowl, which, you know, in your lifetime, you've already seen two of those.
That's right. So this is, as far as the mountaintop is concerned, going to, I was lucky enough when I was 21 to go see the Ravens win the Super Bowl with my dad in New Orleans. That was an all-time moment, all-time weekend, that type of thing. But this is right there. You know, obviously you have a little bit more connection to your university. I've gotten so much more emotionally invested in Georgia over the years. And to see it with my friends like that, and to beat it, I mean, there's a uniqueness of college football where teams just tend to stay at the top, like in Alabama, and you can have the sort of, they are the dragon. They are like the final boss, and Nick Saban being the final boss. It's a unique wrinkle to the college athletics part, and to see it happen and to be down here and to live in this state now is just really, really cool. It was an all timer. I think some of my friends appreciate it even more than I do, but I'll never forget it. It was an unbelievable experience. And yeah, I don't really think anything can top it. I hope at some point in my lifetime that the Orioles can win a World Series, but I'm not holding my breath on that. And that's about the extent of it. I've seen a Maryland Terrapins national championship as well. The mm-hmm. Shout out Juan Dixon. But this to me was like the next thing on the bucket list that I needed to see happen. And I was so excited and lucky to be able to go there and witness it in person.
Yeah, I mean, no disrespect to Sidney Ponzone, but I would not get your hopes up for the Baltimore Orioles. It'll happen at some point in your lifetime, but I don't know that that's going to be next up on the docket. Let's talk about the game itself. I kept telling myself, you know, Alabama's in trouble if they're going to keep taking field goals here. Mm-hmm. And throughout the first, you know, essentially the first three quarters of this game, they got away with it because, you know, it felt like every third down, it was like third and six, and every drive would end with Stetson Bennett fleeing out of the pocket, running right, and throwing the ball out of bounds. And it'd be like, all right, another punt, another punt. And, you know, at some point you start thinking like, Alabama's just going to win this game 15-6. And it's just going to be all field goals. And this will just be another great Nick Saban performance. It's going to be all defense. You know, that's how it's going to go. And then, you know, finally the levee breaks with that touchdown, the Zamir White run. You know, Georgia goes right down the field after that 17 play drive by Alabama ends in a missed field goal. And that to me is when it finally felt like the momentum swung. Alabama comes right back, has to settle for a field goal yet again on another long drive. And at that point, I think if you're Alabama, that's maybe when you have to start worrying. I mean, they scored their lone touchdown of the game on their 10th drive of the game. I mean, it's not often that you see an Alabama offense struggle to this degree. And I think the most shocking thing was it felt like they could get down the field at will. You know, there were a ton of, you know, crossing routes and, you know, dumps out of the backfield to Brian Robinson. Even after losing Jameson Williams, they were able to move the ball from like 20 yard line to 20 yard line. But as soon as they got close to the goal line, they just couldn't figure anything out.
Yeah, the Georgia red zone defense was unbelievable. I think one of the kind of unsung key plays of the game was when Cameron Latu got loose down the sideline, beat Keely Ringo actually, but Ringo was able to chase him down, and then Georgia was able to force a field goal. So whereas in December, Bama was just seemingly scoring touchdowns at will. Georgia's defense was able to just hold them to field goals constantly and keep themselves within a score at every turn in this game, even though the offense really, like you said, didn't click until the late third quarter. It did help early in the game to at least flip the field position to hit that 50-yarder to Pickens. But that 67-yard run from James Cook really started to alter things, and then they were able to punch it in. After that, that was absolutely massive, and coming off, and for them to do that, coming off as the answer to that Bama 17 play drive that ended in that blocked field goal, like that was such a key little sequence in the game. Bama comes back with a field goal, like you mentioned, and then Georgia has that fumble. What did you think in the moment of that fumble? Because from the stands, it was sheer disbelief. It at once looked like it was an incomplete pass just because the ball traveled so far. And right. Then the sheer kind of nonchalance that Branch had as he kind of like collected the ball going out of bounds, it was like, there's no way that he possibly got a foot in, right? Like there, no way. And then, you know, ruling on the field is a fumble recovered by Alabama. And at that point, I think the collective hearts sunk for the Bulldog fans. That was a pretty bleak moment. And then for Bama, they had to fight for it, but they did end up scoring their touchdown on that drive. Right. And it was like, okay, here we get that. That's where like the curse and like the collective sense of dread and the here we go again type of feeling started to creep back in.
So, I mean, I thought they were going to get stuffed again. You know, I believe that touchdown was on third down, right? It was third and goal from like the three, and they had run two terrible plays yet again before that and put themselves in a situation where, you know, you have to get this. Like, I think they probably would have gone for it there after so many field goals. But yeah, I mean, that was obviously a pivotal moment in the game. I do think it was the right call. I mean, I don't know what the textbook rule on that is, because obviously like Bennett's arm ends up moving forward, but the ball was out by the time he, you know, his arm kind of made the throwing motion. And I think this just, you know, it added more fuel to the fire because there was a similar play early on that first Alabama drive with Bryce Young that ended up being called back. And to be honest, I think they were both the right call when you really break it down. I don't know how many views you got in the stadium. I assume they showed it at least a few times on the Jumbotron, but I thought they were both the right call. I mean, the Bryce Young one was interesting because, you know, you had a defender's arm on his arm. So it's kind of like, you know, at that point, does it become a situation where you're almost caught in the middle of the sack and whatever happens, happens? Because technically, yes, he did like throw the ball down, but did he even have control of his own arm at that point? So, you know, either of those, I guess, probably could have gone either way. And it wouldn't have been like a, you know, ruining the title game situation. But I actually thought the refs did a pretty good job in both situations, even though both ended up benefiting Alabama massively.
Right. Yeah. So the first one, because it happened like so early in the game, and my general reaction, like interceptions are another thing where like I'll celebrate during, but things like fumbles that aren't so clear, I even when the team scores, you're like we got to wait until like the extra point is kicked or until the referees uphold it, because it's always going to get reviewed and it's always going to be extremely close. So I didn't get my hopes up too much in on that first one from Bryce Young. But then it just, as the review kind of unfolded for the Stetson Bennett one, it started to become more clear with the duration of the review that it probably was going to go Alabama's way. And then they did show on the Jumbotron the angle that I think is the most damning one for Stetson Bennett, which is his arm is like cocked backwards and the ball is out of it. It's just barely, but his elbow is just barely behind moving forward, but it is a situation where it did look like a fumble. So I do agree with you in the sense that that was the right call, but it just felt like one of those things where it's like, of course that happened, like the closest possible thing. And then, on the back end of it, to not only fumble it, but then to have it be picked up by a guy who barely looked like he was paying attention.
I couldn't believe, in both scenarios, in both fumbles, how casual both sides were. Especially after watching so much NFL this year, where anytime the ball hits the ground, a linebacker picks it up and runs it back 100 yards just in case, mm-hmm. and like one out of 100 times, it actually counts. I just couldn't believe, in a game of that magnitude, ball's on the ground. Like, go pick it up. Like, even on Georgia's fumble, like, I think maybe there was, in that scenario, nobody knew where the ball kind of squirted out to, because it went, way to the left mm-hmm. over to the sideline. But, nobody on Alabama made any effort to stop the Georgia guy who picked it up. And kind of the same situation with Bennett. I just, we've just seen so many guys, kind of overreact to situations like that, that it was strange to me that in the magnitude of this game, there wasn't more of like a scrum for the ball just to be safe. I mean, you would think that's being coached everywhere.
Right. So maybe that just kind of speaks to, from the player's perspective, that the body language seems to suggest that no one knew it was a fumble on the field, because if it was like clear, like ball out, this is a fumble type of thing, then you figure that the players would have been hustling to the ball more. But I think everyone was just sort of like, the ball's out, but it's heading out of bounds, I'll scoop it just because, but whatever. It didn't feel like the players understood that it was indeed a fumble, just because of how close it was, and maybe just like how far down the field it went. Usually, if it was a fumble that went directly out to Bennett's side or behind him, then I think it's a different story where everyone's trying to go get it. But in that type of situation, they just figured, oh, it's like 10 yards from where Bennett got hit. There's no way this is a fumble.
Right. I think that's a good summation. So where were you emotionally on that? Alabama's driving, trying to, at this point, they would need a touchdown and then need the 2 point to tie. And at that point, force overtime. Where are you, emotionally when Kelee Ringo makes that pick? And I don't know if they showed this in the stadium. I'm sure you've seen it since. The angle where you can see the camera trained on the Georgia sideline, where even as Ringo is like at the 5 yard line about to run into the end zone, Kirby Smart is still shouting, go down, go down, go down, which, would have been the proper play there, of course. But I think it's so much cooler that he returned that thing 79 yards. Like, what is there a cooler way to punctuate a national championship win than that?
I don't think so. That was insane, because Bryce Young had obviously given them fits that, they had to defend 57 Bryce Young dropbacks. Like, that is just exhausting for a defense to deal with. For Ringo, a guy that Georgia fought so hard to get on the recruiting trail. I mean, he's a kid from Arizona. You don't see too many of them going this far east to the deep south to play. But to have that interception and then to have the wherewithal and the athleticism to have the convoy in front of him and to like use the blocking to his advantage. And then shout out Dan Jackson. I don't know if you remember from the very end of that play, but Dan Jackson, kind of like a memeable Georgia defender in the sense that, I think if Georgia was at full strength at safety, he probably wouldn't be playing a whole lot this year. Not the most highly touted guy in the world, but he got in the way of Ajayi Hall at the end of that run, and he got completely blown up by him. But it cleared that final 5 yards for Ringo to cross it over into the end zone and to, like you said, punctuate what would turn to be the national title winning play. And then from there, Bama was rattled and you know, down by a lot and having to scramble to try to figure it out there at the end. And they fought hard till the very end, of course, but that play really put the seal in favor of Georgia.
So how much of the, I would imagine this would be coming from Alabama people. How much of the opinion of, well, you know, if we had John Metchie, if Jameson Williams doesn't go down, you know, they had a couple cornerbacks that were out. Like, was that opinion out there? Because I'm surprised. I didn't really see a lot of that on Twitter after the game.
Yeah, I think, and this is coming from someone who watched like 4 hours of Paul Feinbaum yesterday to just kind of continue to soak things in. And we even found a way to stream some like local Alabama radio on the drive back. That is a big sentiment among the Tide faithful. Less so about Metchie, but definitely with Williams. And Williams was causing a lot of problems for the Georgia defense. And I think I'd be lying if I said that losing Williams wasn't a big factor for Alabama. But at the same time, it's hard to feel sorry for them when you have the Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, when you have all five-star receivers that are replacing him. We talked about it, I think, a little bit on the pod last week. The problem that Metchie being out with going into this game was not necessarily the talent level that drop off, but the comfort level and the chemistry with Bryce Young. And that definitely showed some of those receivers definitely weren't on the same page as Young, or maybe just didn't quite go to where Young likes to put the ball, that type of thing. So that definitely played a factor. But Williams' injury certainly was something that changed and altered the game. But I don't know, like, if you were to say that Williams was out going into this game, how much would that have, like, really changed the spread in favor of Georgia? Like, a half a point, maybe? Yeah, maybe a point?
I don't know. It did feel like, and it's hard to say because, you know, the injury happened on, what, like a 40-yard completion, maybe even mm-hmm. more. It did feel like it changed the play calling a little bit. I mean, they ended up throwing the ball, like, 55 times in this game, and they threw it twice as much as Stetson Bennett did. But it did feel like after that it was a lot of short routes, you know, get 8 yards, you know, throw it to Slade Bolden over the middle. Like they really didn't take a lot of shots after that. You know, when you're missing both of those guys, it certainly changes things. But yeah, at the end of the day, I don't mean to imply that it's cheapened in any way. I don't think that's the case at all.
No, it's not. And you know, like, but I think it cuts both ways. I mean, Georgia was out there playing with the most important position on the field, playing with a former walk-on. So, yeah. You know,
that was their choice.
Yes, it was. But, you know, Stetson Bennett being your quarterback, I think it is, that'll be a something that kind of levels the playing field, I guess, if Alabama's going to have to go out there without Jameson Williams. But I digress. It was an important factor in the game, like you said. But I still think that Georgia, at the end of the day, like that, there's no tainting of this title just because Jameson Williams got hurt. And I hated to see that happen in the moment. It was like I was yelling because the play was coming in my direction. And I was sitting like towards the corner of the end zone, and I'm just screaming like, "Look out!" And Williams just like goes and catches the ball, and I'm like, "Oh gosh,
yeah."
It was that was a tough moment. And then he stayed on the ground and obviously was unable to return. And now he's going pro as of earlier today, actually.
Yeah, no surprise there. Hopefully this doesn't impact his draft stock too much. Let's look ahead to next season already. A long way to go, of course. But we have odds for, you know, next year's title. We have Heisman odds already. That's about all you're going to find right now. You know, we'll get some more, you know, conference odds and things like that will trickle out in the coming months. But you're never going to believe this, John. Alabama and Georgia at the top. Alabama to win the national title plus 225 at the DK Sportsbook. Georgia plus 275, followed by some more familiar names: Ohio State, Clemson, Texas A&M, Oklahoma, Michigan, USC. The ninth highest odds to win the title: the Wisconsin Badgers at 35-1.
Yes, I do like that. Wisconsin had some moments this year where they really did look like they. Like if they were to make it to the Big Ten championship game against Ohio State, they would have had a shot. So they'll be obviously a very experienced team going into next year. I think looking at the board, it makes all the sense in the world that Alabama is the odds-on favorite. That they lose a ton of guys, but they lose a ton of guys every year. They bring back the most important guy, though, and that's Bryce Young. Those receivers, I think, are going to get a lot better over the course of this offseason. You know, between Brooks, Hall, handful of other guys, they're going to be pretty nasty. As it stands when it comes to Georgia, and I'd actually like to take this opportunity to maybe pivot the conversation for a second as it pertains to what Georgia does at quarterback next year, because I think that has a lot to do with Georgia's national title hopes. So in case you weren't apprised of this, Stetson Bennett can return to Georgia for another season next year.
Is that something that you want to happen?
It's so crazy because, like, Stetson Bennett is at once, like, walking on water here in Georgia. Like, it's been said a million times, he'll never have to pay for a drink in Athens. He'll never have to pay for a meal in the state for the rest of his days. But I think if you gave any Georgia fan truth serum, I think that they would probably prefer if Stetson Bennett moved on to somewhere else, just because they have this big logjam of like highly touted quarterbacks, and if Bennett were to return, then they're all going to hit the transfer portal, and you know that makes it a little bit harder to recruit the position when you know it's like, well, didn't you make promises to the other five-star guys? And you know, like, if you're talking to a five-star in the 2023 or 2024 class, you know, how much are they going to buy what you're selling when these highly touted guys like your Brock Vandegrifts or your Gunnar Stocktons aren't getting on the field within their first 2 years on campus. So it creates an interesting kind of political dilemma for Kirby Smart to have to navigate. Obviously, he didn't properly navigate the Justin Fields, Jake Fromm situation. But at the same time, it's got to be so hard to just tell a guy that just delivered you the first national title in 41 years, like, yeah, appreciate it, man, but pack your bags.
Yeah, it's fairly unprecedented, right? Where a guy has this kind of ascendance, you know, has really had like one really good throw that in essence pushed Georgia to win this game. I will say, I don't think he was like as bad. Like the way he was getting clowned on Twitter, like midway through the third quarter of this game, I felt like he was under a ton of pressure. There weren't like, it's not like he was just like missing wide open receivers. He was just in a tough spot against a really good defense. I don't think he played that badly. I mean, I'm not saying he's, you know, should be a first round pick in the NFL, but I did think there was a little more piling on than there needed to be. But
I think that a lot of that was just confirmation bias, because I think a lot of people have felt through the course of the entire season, not just Georgia or not just kind of your average or neutral fan, but a lot of Georgia fans, and probably myself included, there's probably plenty of audio on this podcast from this season just being like, I don't want Stetson Bennett. Like, he's not the best quarterback on the team, but he's the one that's starting. It doesn't make sense. Make it make sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's there really hasn't been a situation like this. Part of it is, you know, guys are, you know, kind of have these free years from, you know, from the COVID season that ends up transferring over. But, you know, normally if there was a story like this, you know, you think Joe Burrow, like, you know, Burrow was on the NFL radar, probably would have been a mid to late round pick before that LSU season, but he played so well that all of a sudden he's the number one pick. And, you know, Bennett obviously played well enough to get Georgia to this point and to win the national title. But whereas we've seen other quarterbacks, you know, build their draft stock while their team is ascending, it felt like everybody's been a lot more realistic about Stetson Bennett the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, the former walk-on, so very little like recruiting pedigree. Doesn't really have the NFL frame or the NFL arm, but you know, he's got all the intangibles, all the moxie, all the knowledge in the of the offense and everything like that. So he did exactly what he had to do, and yeah, that throw to A.D. Mitchell to kind of punch back against Alabama when they had that touchdown to go up, that was, I mean, that probably goes down as the biggest throw in Georgia program history.
Yeah, I think that's without a doubt. I don't even know what would be number two. I'm sure there were some nice throws from would have been David Green to Leonard Pope that are maybe in there. But yeah, I mean, iconic play, ridiculous throw, great catch in traffic. I did feel a little bad for, I forget who the Alabama corner was, but he was getting picked on left and right that game.
Right. Yeah. I think he had to excuse me, I think he had like a tweet after the game saying that, you know, two plays don't define me type of thing. I didn't think it was necessarily his fault. I mean, it was just a literal perfect ball and a perfect play on the ball for Mitchell. Like, he had himself in great position. He at no point got toasted in that play. So, I mean, he should keep his head up. Like, he'll be fine.
I think it was the same guy who had the tackle pass interference, which actually was a really smart play.
It was. I was very furious as to how smart that play was, because that is a touchdown, but like absolutely to Burton. And he knew he was beat, and he had to take the penalty. So like, if anything, was a good play by him to, you know, 15 yards versus a long touchdown. You're taking those 15 yards every single time.
So I don't have a whole lot of takes about these title odds. I mean, for the most part, it's about exactly what you'd expect. You know, Bama, Georgia, Ohio State, Clemson, they're always going to be there. That second tier of teams, A&M, Oklahoma, Michigan, USC, Notre Dame, kind of always feels like it's the same. I will say about Wisconsin, I mean, obviously I would never bet Wisconsin to actually win the national title. It's one thing to make the playoff. It's another thing to have the type of team that can win two games against some of those top tier programs. But the schedule is, once again, extremely easy. You know, they do get Washington State at home in the non-conference, but you play at Ohio State. That's really the season defining game, as it always is. But no Michigan, no Penn State. You do have to go to Iowa this year. You do have to go to Michigan State, but you get Minnesota at home. You know, Nebraska continues to not be a threat. So I kind of understand the odds here. Like 35-1 maybe doesn't reflect the quality of team that Wisconsin is, but when you combine, you know, a pretty good team with a very easy schedule, all of a sudden, if they find a way to beat Ohio State, you know, they're going to be in this thing.
No, 100%. Like they always, I feel like, have that immediate path to Indianapolis, like right off the bat, just the way that the rest of the West sets up and just the kind of stability in that program that Wisconsin has. Like, I always feel good about their chances of getting to Indianapolis. And if they're able to do that, you win that one game and you're the Big Ten champion, then you have as good of a case as anyone to get one of those four playoff spots. So it is there in front of Wisconsin for sure. I like that call. I think Michigan is a pretty nice little bet at plus 3,000, just because I think I'm pretty impressed by the freshman that they intended or tried to rotate in a decent bit. At quarterback, I think it's J.J. McCarthy, I believe it is. Yeah. So I think that he can take another step forward this coming season if Harbaugh decides to ride with him. Maybe open up that Michigan passing game a little bit, because that was obviously one of their big undoings against Georgia, was that inability to get explosive plays through the air. So it was once they get down, they were pretty much sunk right there. I think Clemson's in deep trouble right now. They do have a great freshman quarterback coming in, Cade Klubnik. So maybe he can kind of turn around their fortunes. But with the coordinator departures and a really just kind of small recruiting class, I don't know if you can pull up the 24/7 where they ranked it in the recruiting cycle from this past year. But it was not a banner class from Clemson. I think that some of the stuff that they were hanging their hat on, the program stability, the sort of, once you commit to us, like you're committed for good. Like people just aren't really buying that as far as the recruits go anymore. Like that's just not as appealing. They like to go shop around and see, you know, what NIL possibilities there are at other places. They're not just going to completely commit to Clemson alone. Ohio State obviously has to fix their defense, but their offense is going to be absurd once again. I guess A&M is to me like the interesting long shot. We've said it for years. We said it going into the 2019 season, I want to say, the 2020 season, so Kellen Mond's junior and senior seasons. I mean, Jimbo Fisher has pulled in the most impressive recruiting class, not just in the country for this year, but like one of the most impressive recruiting classes ever since they started tracking this thing. So it's a lot of freshmen that you'd have to depend on theoretically, and they're going to have to go to Tuscaloosa, and they don't really have that program cachet to where like, they could win a bunch of games, lose to Alabama, like not make it to the SEC championship game and still find a way in. Like, I don't think that they necessarily get that type of treatment from the committee until they've made it to the playoffs on their own volition, at least a couple of times. But it's a talented roster. They need to get a little bit better in the passing game. The Calzada's gone. Should be Haynes King or maybe this freshman that they brought in. But the defense should be good again. The offensive line, Jimbo's done a really good job recruiting that. Devin Achane is a total stud. So there's a lot to like about A&M. I think that they would be the one that I circled if I was going to sprinkle a little bit right now on some of these championship futures. A&M at plus 2,200.
Let's look at the Heisman odds before we get out of here. And there are a few sources out there. They vary pretty widely, depending on where you look. But we're looking at the Action Network here. I believe these come via FanDuel. We don't discriminate on this podcast. We'll talk DraftKings. We'll talk FanDuel. Doesn't matter. I will say,
love the action.
Yeah, that's Action Network, baby. Braylon Allen is not listed here. And this list is very deep. I mean, there are probably 50-plus guys on this list. I mean, we're talking guys who are plus 45,000. Maryland receiver Rakim Jarrett is on this list, and Braylon Allen is not. So I'm going to put an asterisk here. This is not clearly an official list of odds. I think he'd probably be somewhere in like the 80 to 100 to 1 range. But that is neither here nor there. I really feel like Bryce Young has a pretty good shot to pull the Archie Griffin here, about as good of a shot as anybody has had. And you know, there have been Heisman winners who've come back and haven't finished the job. I get that. But I think the reason I would say that more than anything is this didn't really feel like it was Alabama's best team. You know, it felt like they've had better ones and they could be even better next year. So for him to kind of, you know, back his way into the Heisman in some ways in 2021, he should get better. The team around him should get better. You know, maybe he'll have more competition for it this year, because it certainly didn't feel like a, you know, wire to wire, the year of Bryce Young type of season for him.
Right.
But next year could be that year, you know? So I think he's going to have a pretty decent shot at it.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you framed that well. I mean, we talked about it over the course of the season, how no one really kind of had that Heisman moment. I mean, we were talking about Kenneth Walker being a legitimate Heisman contender, and you know, no disrespect to Kenneth Walker, but you know, his season relative to some of like the Jonathan Taylor seasons, you know, not even in the same stratosphere really. But yeah, Bryce Young, so talented. It's going to be his junior season. It's going to be the second year as the starter. Obviously no Williams or Mechie. So those receivers are going to have to develop around him, but he, you know, he's such an assassin. Like anytime he drops back, it should, strike fear in the heart of whatever team, he's going against. He's just so accurate, such a quick release, so mobile, so able to, you know, get away from pressure. Yeah, he's kind of the complete package when you look at it at a college quarterback. So it makes all the sense in the world that he's sitting atop the Heisman odds and like you said, positioned to Archie Griffin this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you got C.J. Stroud right there. I mean, at the FanDuel Sportsbook, he's plus 350. It was hard for me to like get behind the case for C.J. Stroud this past year. And it's really nothing against him. He had some monster games, played really well, of course. But it just feels like it's kind of like a nameless, faceless position. Like, if you're the Ohio State quarterback, you're going to be in the running for the Heisman. Doesn't matter who you are. And it feels like that's been the case for so long that it's just kind of this factory of guys who are all like vaguely similar, and they all kind of seem to do the same things.
Yeah, that's 100% true. Obviously, they're losing Olave and Wilson, but Jackson Smith and Jigba will be back, and they obviously gave a preview of what's to come with Marvin Harrison Jr. and Emeka Ibuka against Utah. But yeah, I do agree. It's just like generic Ohio State quarterback is sort of what Stroud feels like. He wasn't the five-star that like a Justin Fields was. He's obviously very good, and he'll be more experienced coming into next year, and he'll put up those numbers and he'll stack the wins that are necessary to keep him in that Heisman contention. But like you said, you know, the Heisman moments were mostly lacking for him this past season. I think that the best what you could say was like when he shredded Michigan State's secondary, but everyone did that. So like, that's not all that special.
Yeah. I don't know I was trying to think of like an NBA comparison for him, where it's someone who's just like, you know, the numbers are really good. They're unassailable, but he's just not, you know, he doesn't have a lot of wow plays. He's not super inspiring to watch. Whereas I think Bryce Young, I mean, you know, he's coming off of a fairly rough game against Georgia, but his best plays are like unbelievable. And the poise that he has, how calm he is standing in the pocket, like you could see it with him. Whereas with Stroud, it does seem like there's a little more of a system QB narrative at play there. So looking at these odds, you have those two, you know, Young is at plus 250, Stroud plus 350. Then we have a huge gap starting at 20-1, you know, is where the rest of this list kicks off. And, you know, essentially that tells me like we don't even know, you know, half these guys, there are some names on here. We don't even know where they're going to play. We don't even know if they're going to be the starter at their school. You know, JT Daniels is 20-1. He could start for Georgia. We have no idea. I mean, like you said, Stetson Bennett could be back. Caleb Williams is at 25-1. We have no idea where he's going to play, but we know wherever he ends up, he's going to be in the mix. You got Dylan Gabriel, you got Tyler Van Dyke, you got DJU still at 25-1, a little bit of name recognition there. Keaton Slovis going to take over for Kenny Pickett at Pitt. I mean, we could keep reading name after name. I mean, there are a lot of recognizable names on this list. But I agree with how the odds break down. It'd be really hard to make a compelling case for one guy over the other, because, you know, some of the more proven players on this list, like a Bijan Robinson, you know, it's just hard for a running back. You know, you can't put a running back higher than like 20 or 30-1 these days. And, you know, even someone like a Spencer Rattler, who kind of hit rock bottom last year, he's at 40-1. Maybe he takes off at South Carolina. Who knows?
Yeah, I would have to imagine that like the team context isn't going to be good enough for Rattler. And I feel like Rattler is just constantly as long as he's in college, it is just going to be kind of dangled out there by the Heisman odds makers, for someone believing that he's really, really good or something. And Tyler Van Dyke, to me, it's interesting to me that he's rated this high within this grouping of odds. He obviously had a great season kind of out of nowhere. He kind of has Keaton Slovis vibes to me, where it's just like, he did well relative to expectations, but like you compare him actually to you know, some of the great quarterbacks in college football, and I think he falls a little bit short. I could be wrong in that, and you know, I think Mario Cristobal is going to turn that program around, but I wouldn't put my money on Van Dyke necessarily. Williams to me is a really interesting bet at 25-1. He's just extremely talented. I mean, he was, you know, in the Heisman running with like half of a season worth of games there for a little bit this season. Just I think that wherever he goes, whether it is USC, whether it is somewhere else, he's going to be the guy, and he's going to put up huge numbers and turn them into a winning program. So you have to consider that. I'm definitely interested in Quinn Ewers. I mean, by the numbers, he's like supposedly the best quarterback prospect ever coming out of high school, but by the recruiting rankings, tied with Vince Young. So that can't like not interest you. That has to be something that you keep on your radar. Texas, you know, their offense wasn't their problem this year, really. It was the defense and you know, the quarterback play specifically was a little bit tough, and Bijan Robinson's injury late. But Ewers plus Xavier Worthy, the freshman receiver from this past year, that's such a deadly combo. So I think that he's a really interesting play. And then Smith and Jigba, if the games when Ohio State was slightly shorthanded at receiver this season and allowed Smith and Jigba to step up, like he delivered and then some. I mean, the Rose Bowl performance was just silly, and his game against Nebraska was also just silly. So they're going to be throwing the ball a lot. He obviously has more trust with Stroud than some of those younger guys. So I think Smith and Jigba, if like there's a receiver that are going to be that is going to be positioned for Heisman candidacy, I think him and Xavier Worthy would be my two that I take a look at.
All right, Ben, enjoy checking in with you on this. More than anything, congratulations. Like I said at the top, I feel like you're as big a part of this as anybody, bigger than Stetson Bennett, even perhaps.
I've been banging the gong for a while. I was feeling like it was the dog's year ever since the end of last season. Did I see it unfolding the exact way that it did? Absolutely not. But, you know, I put down during the RotoWire trip to Las Vegas, I put money on the dogs winning it all. I just felt like they had the best team going into this season. Obviously hit the bump on the road in December, but very cool to see them finish this off, and I'll leave it at this. Go Dawgs.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.